Okay. So good morning, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you. And can you hear okay? Is it working? Becca out in the outer room too, you can hear? Out there? Great. I've been thinking these last days about a little bit more traditional Theravadan topic than maybe is talked about here in America when they talk. People talk about Vipassana practice, and that is that the traditional Buddhist path is sometimes called a path of purification, and sometimes when the path is described in stages of development. Sometimes it's described as going through stages of purification or different stages of purity that are attained or reached. And I know that when I was my early years of doing Buddhist practice, I was quite reluctant, to say the least, to adopt any kind of spiritual point of view that or framework for my experience that entailed the notions of purity and impurity. In part, I was practicing in the Zen tradition, which had a kind of non-dualistic take on these things. And would you divide the world into that which is acceptable and that is not acceptable seemed to add a lot of suffering and unnecessary burden to the life we're living. And the Zen tradition, they talk about don't do that. Don't divide the world into the pure and the impure. And there's a famous Zen story that I liked back then quite a bit about there was a Buddhist, very highly attained Buddhist monk in ancient China who was so highly attained that the animals would come and birds would come and sit on his shoulders and the deer would come up and just kind of nuzzle against his thigh, and the animal just came to him. They felt very safe around him, and he had such purity and whatever that the animals came. And it seemed, really wonderful. And then he attained more, and his attainment went further, and he attained more like full enlightenment, and the animal stopped coming. And this was considered really great in Zen, because there was kind of a stink of purity when the animals came to him. There was kind of attachment to this state of purity. And he'd gone beyond both pure and impure, his next level of attainment. And there's a lot of people who I see a number of people who get attached in various ways to the notion of purity. They're attached to that which is pure, and they want they want to have certain kind of purity for themselves. They expect purity of a certain kind in their teachers or in their communities or around. And sometimes it can cause a tremendous amount of suffering, the attachment to purity, because people then feel that, they become very judgmental sometimes. People are really attached to purity. And then realize how impure that is. Self-righteous. And they really feel like they have the right thing, the right way. And there's a kind of disregard or sometimes an unwillingness to look at that which is considered impure. There's often a degrading of that which is impure. Or if there's something impure in one's own mind, so-called impure, then there's a feeling that, I have to hide it, I can't accept it, I'm terrible, I'm bad, I'm a failure, or whatever. It can get pretty nasty in there, in the mind, when you set yourself up, to measure yourself as being impure. And I was very happy to be practicing in traditions that didn't have this notion of purity and impurity, at least in the rhetoric. But lately I've been thinking about this some, and certainly thinking that, if the Buddha talked about it, maybe it's worth at least reflection upon. We don't have to accept everything the Buddha said, but to discount it kind of offhand seems a bit of a, maybe unnecessary. But I've been thinking about this day of the path of purification, and thinking there's something really, really important to understand here. And And maybe we can understand in part if we translate it as a path of cleansing, of cleaning oneself also. That is part of what the path is about. And mindfulness is the soap that does the cleansing, that does the purification. And there are two kinds of things which get cleansed or purified as we do mindfulness practice. Whether you want that to happen, or because you don't believe in such things, or whether you do believe in such things, it happens anyway. And it's like the story, is it Niels Bohm, a story of very famous physicist from the last century, who had a horseshoe for good luck above his door in his office. I think it was him. And someone came to him and said, certainly you're this great physicist and, you know, a great scientist, and you certainly can't believe in horseshoes going to bring you good luck. And he said, oh no, I don't believe in such things, but I hear it works anyway. So I think there's two general categories of things that kind of get purified or cleansed as we do the practice. And one is a very interesting category of things, which often is called or categorized as the accumulations, that which we accumulate over time. And we're all accumulators. And even if we don't accumulate things, the accumulation is not things. Accumulation is sometimes translated as the karma within us, which is a very kind of difficult word for many people in the West, foreign word. But we accumulate habits, we accumulate the consequences of our ongoing reactivity. So, for example, if you go driving on the freeway and you're always pushing the gas pedal, always in a rush, and you're always a little bit tense about driving, then you're perhaps accumulating a tendency towards tension. And so when you get to your destination, the shoulders and the stomach doesn't relax automatically because you've arrived, maybe a little bit, but there stays a little bit of accumulated residue of that reactive way of driving, or that emotional way of driving. So that tension maybe remains a little bit in your shoulders for a while. And if you do it a lot, that kind of activity, then it becomes chronic and maybe even almost kind of frozen or locked in into your shoulders, the tension there. And maybe there's an accumulated result of maybe you have a little bit of a headache because of that. And so you have to go into your meeting for the next hour with a little bit of that headache because of the way you're driving. Or the way you're driving, you accumulate a certain kind of agitated energy in your mind. And so your mind is a little more agitated and active because of the way you drove. And you've accumulated momentum of agitation. And so this momentum carries on beyond when you stop doing the activity. So accumulation can maybe be understood as the momentum that we set into motion by how we live our lives and what we do. And there's a whole range of ways in which this works and things that we accumulate, from habit formations, from energetic kind of ways in which the mind works, byways of the mind. The mind gets channeled in a certain direction from repeatedly doing the same thing over and over again. If you're always an aversive, always kind of judging other people negatively and being critical, you're kind of setting up a groove in the mind that becomes easier and easier, in a sense, to take that route. Or if you're always being generous, it's easier for the mind to set a groove, and it's easier for the mind to kind of think that way and sort of momentum in that direction. And also, there's the momentum or the accumulation of memories that are stored within us, wherever memories are stored. And things can be forgotten for decades, and then they can come back into memory suddenly, and I haven't thought about that for a long, long time. And sometimes meditation has the function of bringing things back into memory that had long been forgotten. And seemingly, more often than not, it's things which maybe need to be remembered, things that are kind of unfinished in the ancient past, things which are maybe have some kind of charge still to them, and the charge is still residing someplace in the psyche, and that it needs to somehow be released, that charge. And it can be good memories and bad memories. And so some people have the experience, like I've had, of it happened especially in the early period of a meditative career, is that things that you've done in the past that you don't feel so good about come back and visit you. And, you know, you, and you think you're supposed to be in the present moment and you have these memories and therefore you're a bad meditator, it's actually part of the cleansing process that's happening. Things are coming into consciousness and needs to be cleaned. And so, oh, wow, I said that to that person? I mean, some of the things I did to my high school girlfriends came back and visited me 10 years later, and you know, I felt very bad. You know, I did that. I didn't know. You know, at the time, I didn't even have the wisdom to see what I was doing. But it was there somehow, the charge. And sometimes really good memories came up back. Things like a sense of wholeness that I had as a young child that I'd forgotten about returned to me from in the meditative states and were very supportive and helpful for the furthering of my practice. So these things are accumulation. We accumulate things in our muscles. We accumulate things in our memory. We accumulate things in the habit formation of the mind. And there might be other byways in which we accumulate things, sometimes collectively kind of, almost sometimes mysteriously defined as the karma that we accumulate, that we don't know how it thinks, the channels by which things pop up many years later. And part of what mindfulness practice entails is, to a certain degree, it's a cleansing process of this accumulation. One friend of mine who's a Vipassana teacher and very good practitioner, he says that when he goes on retreat, if he hasn't been on retreat for a while, the first week of the retreat is taking care of the accumulation that's built up. And then he can go into other things in his practice. And that was a whole week of that. And some people only go on a week-long retreat. And it's very helpful to know this, because some people, when they come to go on retreats, for example, or they do meditation, they think something is wrong because this stuff is coming up. And you know, suddenly they're aware of these things and something's wrong. It's not supposed to be this way. So, for example, it's very common for people to sometimes, occasionally, to feel like they're going backwards in their practice. I was going along just fine in my life until I meditated. And then suddenly I'm aware of, I have all this, you know, there's all this, I'm getting really tense. I wasn't tense before, but now I'm tense. And it isn't that they're getting tenser usually. It can happen. But it's because meditation is a high-risk sport. do it at your own risk. We should have a sign outside. What was I saying? Yeah, before that? Oh, tense. Oh, tension in your body, yes. So it isn't that you're getting tense, but rather the tension that's there, that's hidden, because we're so busy with our mind paying attention to other things, or the surface kind of, you know, muscles are kind of masking it, it gets revealed sometimes. And it's not uncommon for people to come and report, I have this tremendous pain in my back or my shoulders, and something wrong with me. Nothing's wrong, it's just that it's being revealed in the process of being cleansed. So the analogy I like for this is that if your clothes are dirty and you put them in the washing machine with soap, and the machine agitates the water in the clothes, and the water gets dirty. And very few of us, I think, maybe none of you, get angry at the water for being angry. It's like you're really happy that water is dirty because it means it's leaving the clothes and going into the water. If you kind of extend this analogy to our psyche, then we have these impurities in our psyche. We have these accumulations, these tendencies, and they you know. And mindfulness is the soap. Meditation is the agitation, and the water of our psyche is consciousness. So as the mindfulness works, these things come out into the water of consciousness. They have to go somewhere, right? We would like them just to vanish. But as they come into the water of consciousness, and rather than being upset by that, or discouraged by that, or be self-critical, oh, you know, how a terrible person I am, because it's actually a healthy sign of healing, a healthy sign of spiritual development to let these things, the accumulation, pass through the water, and the water is consciousness. So to know that, then you can have much more equanimity and acceptance. Oh, the accumulations are passing through me. And your job as a meditator is not to add more accumulation on top of accumulation, which is if you judge it or criticize it or get angry for it being there, then you're accumulating further tendencies. But just to be very accepting of it and just trust the mindfulness itself. And this is really the theme of today's talk, which is maybe the theme of every talk I ever give, is you can really to trust mindfulness, trust the simple act of being aware of what's there, what's present, and that's enough. You don't have to judge it or criticize it in some negative way. Just, oh, this is what's there, and just trust the power of mindfulness as a baseline. So this cleansing process, and the cleansing process, accumulations that reveal themselves come out, sometimes happen very subtly, very slowly over time, and sometimes they happen with great force, depending on what happened to us or what we've done in the past, and whatever, I don't know all the reasons why, for some people it comes with a big bang, but in the ancient Buddhist discourses of the Buddha, they sometimes use the word vanta. They vant the impurities get vantad, the defilements get vantad, and usually in English it's translated as purged, which is kind of a strong word, but the word is actually vomit. And you can understand why some English translators don't want to use the word vomit. You know, it doesn't quite lend itself to edification. But the word is actually vomit. And there are very occasionally there are people who actually get very nauseous when they sit down to meditate. It happened to me in my early retreats, the first days or something. I would get really nauseous and kind of get headachy. And I think it was certainly a big transition for the psyche to go into a silent space, not talking and not be engaged in normal ways. But as the normal kind of ways of engagement stopped, some of the deeper stuff that was there kind of surfaced. And, you know, as it was getting purged, this headache and nausea came. And very, 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 very occasionally, I've never seen it, but I've heard of people actually vomit because of this, you know, it's like this physical kind of reaction that happens. And I don't think it's because they're physically sick. It can happen that way. But sometimes it happens because of this tremendous power of purging this accumulation that's there. Some people hold tremendous pain and darkness and stuff in their psyche, in their wherever the psyche is, you know, in their body, in their muscles, and whatever. Some people have done horrible things in their lives, really horrible things, and sometimes the what it took to do that, or the accumulation of having killed someone, for example, you know, just starts churning in the system, and to face that, it's just so nauseating, and has to be, you know, so it gets purging, happens. And then there's, you know, I had spent a lot of time with my pain, my physical pain. I still have that, the accumulation of tension in my body. I still accumulate tension in my body from how I live my life. You know, it's much less than it used to be, but it still happens, and then I meditate, and the meditation cleanses it, kind of empties it. And some certain kinds of things that accumulate get cleansed or get emptied or relaxed in the course of a daily sitting practice. And certain things, I need to go on retreat to have certain deeper tensions kind of, and only after 2 or 3 days or sometimes on retreat to certain kinds of tensions in my shoulder let go. And one of the exquisite sensations that I have, I know about, is the sensation when my shoulder blade begins to float or sink down my back. It's so sweet. In daily life, I don't usually have that kind of freedom in the shoulder blades, so they actually kind of start floating along the back rib cage. So the cleansing process of these accumulations is part of the... I remember some Thai teachers talking about this process, and they say a lot of people understand the importance of cleansing their body. They shower every day, they put on clean clothes, they clean their homes, they do cleansing, you know. But very few people understand the value of cleansing their mind. And some people don't want to cleanse their mind because that implies that their mind is somehow dirty. And the mind is who they are. They don't want to admit they're dirty. The mind isn't who you are. So it's okay to clean it. You don't have to take blame for what's on your mind. Just this stuff arises. And and meditation is the way of cleansing the mind. And I've reflected a number of times in the last decade or so, last 5 years, kind of did the imagination exercise of what I might have been like if I had never meditated. If I'd reached my age, the current age that I am now, if I'd never meditated. And in my imagination, I had no idea. Maybe I would have been better off, who knows. But in my imagination of how it would have been, it's a frightening picture. If the trajectory I was on continued, you know, uninterrupted by my spiritual practice, it's a frightening picture. So this cleansing process. I remember when I was living at the San Francisco Zen Center, we would meditate twice a day, and I'd meditate in the afternoon at about 5:30. And the morning meditations were what they were kind of sweet. And then the afternoon, after a day of working, and being busy and engaged, we would sit for 40 minutes. And the first 20 minutes of those sittings in the afternoon, it was really clear I was kind of processing or emptying or cleansing myself of some of the things that accumulated during the day. And often it took the shape of being tired and agitated and all this stuff. And I learned this was part of the pattern for me, was this first 20 minutes would be this way. And then after 20 minutes, some of the stuff of the day it's kind of been cleansed free of, and then I'd be very alert and clear for the last 20 minutes. So to take care of the mind, to cleanse the mind, as you would anything else, is a very important, I think, thing that human beings can do, and maybe be helpful if they did it. So on one hand, there's the things that get purified in practice are the things that accumulate, the accumulations over time. The other thing that gets cleansed or purged, purified. This is very simple. There's other categories of purification the tradition has, but the other thing, I'm using two categories today. The other category is what's called the latent tendencies. And these are not the what accumulates over time, but rather they're almost like a universal human, kind of innate, the idea is we're born in with them. And they don't even belong to your personality. You don't take them personally. But these are the latent tendencies to certain. Sometimes the word is used defilements in relationship to them, which was a word I also didn't like in the past. Another translation of defilements, klesha, is afflictive tendencies, which I like much better. Afflictive means those tendencies of the mind that cause us pain. And so that makes much more sense to me. Because defilements always sounds kind of negative and aversive, but it's true that certain ways in which my mind works causes me pain. If I'm consumed with hate, I'm hurting myself. If I'm consumed with greed, there's a kind of damage to myself I do. If I afflict myself with certain suffering, the afflictive tendencies. These are also called sometimes the latent tendencies, or the latent dispositions, those things which are maybe hidden often from view, but are ready to operate in the right conditions. So if someone who's really attached to purity goes off and finds a wonderful ashram in India where everyone wears white and everyone just eats fresh fruit and nuts and everybody is celibate and no one handles money and all the ideas of what's impure are kind of kept away from them. It's a very relaxed life. They get a nice amount of sleep, a nice meditation, and nice massages, and they have a nice swimming pool there, and in the cold season, they have a nice kind of sauna, the story goes on and on. It's very nice and pleasant, and you feel like you've arrived in heaven, and it's just like this is it, you know. And you be there for several months or years, and not a single instant of anger arises in your mind, not a single kind of tendency towards greed and grasping arises. I mean, why would you grasp when you have all these wonderful things around you? So it's, wow, I've arrived. I must be enlightened. And then you get a phone call from your stockbroker in New York who says, we're having trouble paying for all these things. And you need to come back and deal with some of this yourself because it's too much for me. And you go back to your office and your stockbroker and you look at, and you read the newspapers and your spouse is there with the kids waiting for you, and say, how could you be gone so much, and here you are, you take care of them for a while, and then they have the mortgage and the insurance, and you know, all these things have to be taken care of, and you know things that you do, right? And it's, oh my God, you know, and this is too much for me, and all this irritation and anger and you know, desire and fear, all these things come right back up. I guess I wasn't so enlightened afterwards. So one strategy then, response, is to run back to the ashram. And the other strategy is to now begin to take responsibility for how you actually are in the world and actually face these kinds of tendencies. Look at this and take responsibility. Look for our ability to respond to them in a healthy way with mindfulness, with clarity. So the latent tendency was there waiting kind of in the wings in the ashram in India. And part of the purging or the purification process that the Buddha pointed towards was not simply kind of becoming stress-free, getting free of the stress that accumulates, but having spiritual practice that addresses the latent tendencies of greed and hate, the latent tendencies towards clinging to self, the latent tendencies towards, there's a number of them, there's one list of seven, which I can't remember now. And for that, sometimes it's very hard to be motivated to free oneself of latent tendencies because maybe you don't see them. They're latent. And also you don't want to admit you have them because that's kind of unfortunate news. But the teachings of the Buddha is they're kind of, you're born with them in a sense. And you don't have to take them personally. Everyone has them, these latent tendencies, unless they do the spiritual work or the psychological work to somehow uproot them. And part of the function of mindfulness practice and concentration practice is to develop enough mindfulness and concentration so you can look beyond the surface of the mind, the surface kind of thoughts of the mind, thinking mind, and really look deep into the kind of recesses of the mind, the roots of the mind, and what really kind of gets the whole apparatus of mind operating, what makes it tick, what makes it kind of, what propels it. And very few people look very deeply into the roots of the mind. People are content with a surface mind. And you know, if you're involved with a surface mind, you're trying to rearrange things to make life more comfortable. And trying to figure out, you know, philosophically, what's the right understanding and moving philosophy around and trying to get a better sense of identity and a better, this is a better identity. I'll let go of that identity because that's not so good, but this one's a better one. And this is who I really am and hold on to that. And kind of rearrange the surface kind of the mind. It's really like rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic. You know, the ship's going down. You need to do something deeper. And the deeper thing is to look under the surface of the mind. And that's why the mind needs to be very concentrated and very still to really see the subtlety of what's going on. To find the roots, find the really root of clinging to self-identity, to clinging to security, clinging to, to greed and aversion and all the different things that we cling at the root level. And so part of the purification process then is to purify ourselves of these latent tendencies. And that's a lot harder to do than cleansing ourselves of the accumulation. And a lot of people are content with cleansing themselves of the accumulation. Then occasionally someone is very self-satisfied with the results of purifying the accumulations because it's very pleasant. It can feel really great. Suddenly you're free of all this accumulated kind of stuff. And there's kind of clarity and sense of being cleansed and much more equanimity and feel, oh, I've done what had to be done. This is, you know, great. And I'll just rest on my laurels. Not to be diminished, the value of doing that. It's quite beautiful. And to be able to go into the world without all those accumulations kind of hanging around you is a real gift, I think, we give to everyone. But in the teachings of the Buddha, what he was really, I believe, you know, pointing towards ultimately was a possibility of going further than freeing ourselves of stress and going down into these root tendencies of the mind. And I don't know what I'm about to say now is fair or right as a characterization, so you'll have to hold this lightly. But maybe as a caricature, it may be kind of somewhat accurate, and caricatures may be. Is the teachers like myself, Vipassana teachers like myself and other American insight meditation teachers, I think it'd be listening to them, it'd be easy to get maybe the impression that the goal of the practice is to develop mindfulness and equanimity and acceptance to such a degree that you can accept yourself completely as you are. And, but you're not supposed to be transformed. You're supposed to just, you're still allowed to be neurotic. That, you know, you get angry, and you know, what you're supposed to do is just be very spacious about the anger and not buy into it, not get caught by it, be free of any kind of tendency to act on it. And just the anger is there, and it's very wonderful, it's very powerful. I mean, I'm not going to belittle how powerful and significant it is to hold anger in a spacious mind and not buy into it and not kind of just kind of acceptance of it that doesn't buy into it, doesn't act on it, but just holds it there, doesn't criticize it, doesn't get... The mind is very, very equanimous about it. That's a very, it's a stage of practice which is very important. But I think it'd be easy to listen to us as teachers to think that's the, really the goal of practice. That's the it. If you can just attain that, you're supposed to really just be who you are and just hold it in that spacious, accepting awareness. Is that a kind of fair character? Have you, some of you gotten that impression, or am I just deluded as a teacher? I've been listening to myself too much. Is it fair? Maybe? Kind of? What?
You're deluded.
I'm deluded, yeah. Thank you, thank you. I feel confirmed. I set myself up for that, didn't I? But the teachings of the Buddha is to go further than that kind of acceptance. That's like a stage in practice. It's very important, that level of equanimity. But we're supposed to go further than that and really begin uprooting those tendencies so that sooner or later you find yourself in a situation where maybe, actually, you never get angry at your spouse. It isn't simply you get angry at your spouse and you're able to hold it spaciously and not get into trouble with it. Just, you know. But you simply don't have a tendency to get angry. So, you know, I'm not so highly attained, but the, at all. Be careful with that. I felt really, really happy that at a certain point in my years of practice, I thought, I've really attained something important here. I really kind of done some, you know, this is really significant. And it wasn't that I attained great states of bliss and great states of emptiness and great states of realization and great whatever states of meditation. The great attainment that I attained was I was able to get through a meditation retreat without getting angry. Wow, you know, because I used to get so angry, so irritated and upset at myself and meditation and everything, you know. And it was just set up, the accumulated tendencies of anger just popped up, you know. It's kind of like we have these deeper undercurrents of tendencies of acting and being. And as normal kind of busyness of the mind quiets down, sometimes the underlying tendencies show themselves much more dramatically. And it can be very discouraging unless you've been told this might happen. Say, oh, good. I'm told this happens. This is part of the process. It's really good this is happening. So I can, you know, it's entering into the water. I can cleanse myself. But at a certain point, so I would notice this, I would get angry in these early retreats. And then I stopped being angry. So I'm not sure if that's a, you know, I don't know, I'm not sure if that's a really great attainment, but I was really happy with it and took it as an encouragement. Maybe I just kind of, I don't know. But so the cleansing process, the purifying process of practice. I had one more thing to say, I thought of saying, but I've forgotten. So I think that's my thoughts for today. Do you have any comments or questions about that? Yeah?
It was interesting that you were talking about the personality or the afflictions. I was wondering what the Buddha thought about like the adaptive personality that comes through early years, that, you know, the parental stuff.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
is that in there too, somewhere?
Child development, the Buddhist theory of child development. I don't know if that's there in the Buddha's teachings, but there is a wonderful story of a monk who was considered, it was an arhat, he was fully an enlightened person, and he was out on tour walking around the countryside with other monks, and they all kind of knew that he was, anyway, and so they had to ford a stream. It was a really shallow stream. And he yanked up his robes and pranced across the stream kind of wildly. And the other monks looked at this and said, this is not very dignified. This is rather unbecoming. This is not, a monk is supposed to be dignified bearing and, you know, always carry themselves mindfully. And this guy just kind of yanked up his skirt, you know, and just kind of maybe even exposed himself, you know, danced, they don't wear underwear, monks. And then they, you know, pranced across. And so they went to the Buddha. And they said, you know, what's going on with this monk? You know, this is not very dignified. And the Buddha said, oh, it's okay. He is fully enlightened. But in a former lifetime, he was a monkey. And his monkey nature is still coming through occasionally. And one of the great things to see is, if you visit a lot of teachers who are kind of well-attained teachers, is how different they all are. And some, you know, are the embodiment of what you think a really spiritual person is like, you know, serene and calm and just wise and whatever, you know, whatever your ideal is. You know, you might find that person. And then the neighboring guy, who's just as highly attained, you know, was a boxer in his young life and is really feisty and, you know, is ready to kind of just kind of, it feels like he's ready to punch you out, just like right there in your face. And, you know, he spits a lot. And, you know, and how can this be, you know? And it just, you know, all people are very different personalities, different conditioning perhaps as children. But the afflictive tendencies are gone. Both people have gone. So they're not, there's a tendency towards greed, hate, fear are not there anymore. But, you know, the form it takes, you know. And so it's very good to see very many different teachers, so you don't think that that particular teacher is the way you're supposed to become. You're supposed to be, you know, there's a personality in a sense of who you are. And that becomes you're freer as you practice. And as Jack Kornfield says, the more enlightened you get, the more eccentric you get. Other thoughts? Questions? Yes, please. I don't know so well. I mean, I could. I don't really know. I could give you some ideas of how it happens. There seems to be some mysterious process that goes on here in it. So it involves very deep mindfulness and concentration, where the mind gets very still and equanimous. And in that state, one of the things that can happen is we can see what's really going on in the roots of the mind. It's kind of like if someone does a magic trick, you could be fascinated by the magic trick for a long time. You could watch it and watch it and watch it until you see how the trick is done. And then you lose interest. So when you see how the trick of the mind works, how we've been fooled all along, then you're no longer going to be fooled by that anymore. So if you see, you know, that desire, you know, desire is very alluring and enchanting. But when you really see that, you know, that enchantment is, you know, you see how the trick is done, then you're not so likely to be allured anymore by desire. So some of it, I think, involves seeing very deeply. But some of it seems to be somewhat mysterious, perhaps. And that is, at some points in practice, the experience of Nibbana is kind of this radical falling away of any remnants of clinging in the mind. Almost like the awareness or consciousness itself is like a clinging. And that when that clinging falls away, the clinging of consciousness itself, in a sense, there is no consciousness left, perhaps. So you can't talk about what that experience is like. And when people come out of that experience, there seems to be that some of these deeper roots are cleansed. So what happens in that dark box of falling away of consciousness and why that's cleansing? I don't have a really good answer. Other teachers might have a better explanation. But certainly by seeing that possibility, seeing that, it's kind of like the trick has been, you've seen through the trick. You see that nothing is worth clinging to. You see that, you see in a sense that maybe some people would say the innate nature of who you are is radically empty or free of all the things that we cling to and hold on to, and you've had a taste of the radical letting go of any kind of clinging. And then from then on, you're not so inclined to cling anymore because you know that possibility of not clinging. You've seen the trick. So that's the best I can do. Is that enough? Is the morning feel complete? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Feels complete? How about that? That's nice. So many thanks, and I wish you all well. And it would be nice if many of you came to the community meeting tonight. Part of the function of the community meeting is just to get together as a community in a different way and see each other and talk to each other in different ways. If you come a little bit earlier than 6:30, then we can kind of hang out a little bit and talk maybe and socialize. And also to share and kind of taking care of the stewardship of our center, not just the physical center, but also just of our community as part of the function of the business meetings or the community meetings. So it'd be nice if you came. And my hope is that these community meetings don't feel just like kind of uninteresting, boring business meeting, but that the community meetings really feel like they're a significant place of spiritual practice, just like our other programs are, and that they're actually rewarding and satisfying, as if you feel that they're and that's part of our task is over the months and years to find how to hold these meetings so that feel like they're actually nourishing for us rather than just kind of a drag to do. So that's at least the intention, and I hope many of you come So, thank you again.